Okay, well, welcome once again. So the theme for this month, this is week four, a four-week theme, on a wise relationship to practice. And we have been exploring this relationship to practice through the perspective of the five spiritual faculties. So on the first week, I spoke about Shraddha, or faith, confidence, and conviction, and its relationship to prajna, or wisdom and discernment, and how these two qualities, or these two faculties, support each other and actually need to be balanced and harmonized with each other. Then during week two, we spoke about smriti, or mindfulness, or the process of recollecting. And we spoke about that in terms of fundamentally just this ability to pay attention upon one's chosen object of attention, to notice what is present, and to notice what is not present, and to notice more clearly, to see more clearly the consequences of our actions. And then on week three, we focused on virya, or diligence, persistence, or energy in pursuit of the good. And last week, around this topic, we explored this idea through this image from the Pali Canon, through a teaching of the Buddha, where he was speaking to one of his disciples, Sona, who was a skilled lute player before he left the worldly life and became a Buddhist practitioner. And the Buddha used this image of a lute string, which is either too taut or too loose, and to tune our diligence, our persistence. So we spoke about that last week. And this week, this final week, we're actually going to be focusing on samadhi, or concentration. And actually this topic of concentration, it's a vast topic. Actually, all of these are quite vast. So over the course of 4 weeks, we can only really just sort of touch in on some key themes. So in terms of samadhi, there are these two broad categories of meditation or concentration. And these two broad categories are called in samatha and vipassana. And samatha practices, meditation practices, samatha translates as practices which calm the mind, calm the heart. So these are focusing or unification practices, if you will, that calm the mind. So you have samatha, calming practices, and there are also vipassana practices. And vipassana translates as insight. So insight here falls into the category of this faculty here, prajna, or wisdom and discernment. So samadhi and prajna, there's also a very close relationship between these two spiritual faculties. So what we're going to be focusing on tonight, what's going to be in the fore, is actually the aspect of a meditation of calming practices, of samatha. And then I'm going to just touch in on some themes around vipassana practice, or insight practice, and actually the month of August, when we're going to be doing a meditation practice period during Sangha night, vipassana will definitely take a leading role during Sangha night, during the month of October, month of August. Okay, so samatha practice. So what's traditionally spoken about, what's traditionally taught by the Buddha around meditation or samatha meditation, is the Buddha teaches what are called the four dhyanas. And this word dhyana can be translated as concentration or absorption, states of absorption, or states of unification of the mind, something like that, or concentration, meditation. And the Buddha described four dhyanas. He actually described eight dhyanas. But we're only going to be talking about the first four and not the second four set of dhyanas. So these first four dhyanas, they do not have names. They're just referred to as the first dhyana, second, third, and fourth dhyanas. And what you will find in teachings around this is that there will be different qualities associated with each one of these dhyanas. And each of the four dhyanas include the top row here of one-pointedness. So all four dhyanas include this quality of one-pointedness. And then the first dhyana, in accompanied with one-pointedness, is initial thought and sustained thought. And we can just think of these two things as simply thinking. And it's also accompanied by what's called rapture and bliss, which I'll say more about later. Then what happens when one enters into the second dhyana is initial thought and sustained thought actually dissolve. So our thinking mind actually quiets. So that internal voice in our heads, it actually subsides when we enter into the second dhyana and beyond. And what's still present are these qualities of rapture and bliss. And then the third dhyana, rapture dissolves and we're left with bliss. Again, I'll say more about what's being pointed at here. And in the fourth dhyana, both of these qualities, rapture and bliss, also dissolve. And what arises is this quality of equanimity. So now I'd like to say a few words about each one of these qualities. So first of all, in terms of one-pointedness. So when one hears this word, one can think of, oh, that must mean I'm going to focus my mind on a chosen object of attention and just keep my mind there, one-pointedness. So one can easily come away with this impression from the mindfulness of breathing, for example, where we choose the breath as our object of attention and we attempt to anchor our attention upon that chosen object, the breathing body. So in the first stage, you know, we're counting our breaths. Actually, in the first two stages, we're counting our breaths. And it's very interesting, in the third and fourth stages, in the third stage, we drop the counting, and the object of our attention becomes our entire breathing body. And in the fourth stage, we then narrow the focus of our attention to a one-pointed focus, very narrow focus, which is the point in our bodies where we first experience the breath entering our bodies. So we have this, in the third stage, a broadening out of awareness to include our breathing bodies more holistically. The fourth stage, a narrowing of our attention to a single point. So from this idea of the fourth stage, of a narrowing, one can come away with this impression that, well, one-pointedness, that must mean we focus upon a single object, if you will. And that's fair enough. That is one aspect of one-pointedness. However, if that's it, it's actually missing a lot. So what this quality of one-pointedness is pointing at more fully, more holistically, it's pointing at this a state of being where the mind and the heart become unified. It's a unification of mind. I love this translation for samadhi, unification of mind. So when we think about our minds, or we reflect upon the quality of our minds, you know, when we're going about our day-to-day lives, so many people will experience their minds as just being kind of all over the map. Just kind of thinking about this, thinking about that. The mind is just so full of stories. And when we look more closely at the content of those stories, we may notice that actually a lot of those stories are quite toxic. They're quite harmful. And they're quite habitual. They can be very familiar. So we can have stories about the person at work who I don't like, or my partner, or whatever, then my neighbor. We can have all sorts of stories. We have stories about ourselves, like this internal voice, this harsh inner critic that's constantly kind of measuring our experience and judging ourselves and our experience against what we want. We can have all these stories. So in Buddhism, there is this term called prapancha. And this word is typically translated as mental proliferation, prapancha, mental proliferation. And this is a quality that actually begins to dissolve as we enter into deeper states of concentration. So in terms of this mental proliferation, this mental proliferation can very much take the form or be spoken about in terms of the five hindrances, which I've written over here. So the five hindrances, again, this is a traditional term that is given to this set of this list of five qualities. And I put an alternative translation for this. This is my own translation, if you will. Or the five ways in which we create and perpetuate suffering for ourselves and others. So before I speak about the five hindrances, what's traditionally taught in relationship to the dhyanas is what's traditionally taught is when one enters into a state of unification of mind or absorption of the mind, that the hindrances are no longer present. So something dissolves in our experience when we enter into a state of concentration. So a very good question to ask, a very interesting question is, what is it that dissolves? What is left behind? What are we leaving behind when we enter into dhyana? And we're leaving behind what are called the five hindrances. So in terms of the five hindrances, what are the five hindrances? So I'll just name them. In the center is doubt, which is the flip side of faith, or confidence, conviction. So there's doubt in the center, which actually fuels the whole thing, doubt. One of the things that fuels this whole story. And then left and right, there's a pair of opposites. On the right is ill will. On the left is desire for sense pleasure. And we can relate to this pairing as simply the push and pull of our wants and desires and aversions. So it can so much feel like our experience, we're just being kind of tossed around sometimes, just being pushed and pulled, and I want this, and I don't want that, and I'm not getting what I want. So with this pairing, desire for sense pleasure and ill will, there's always a story, there's always a narrative associated with this. There's always a theme that we have tuned into when we allow either of these two hindrances to invade our minds and remain. Top and bottom, on the top we have restlessness and anxiety, on the bottom is sloth and torpor. And we can relate to this pair in terms of energy. So we can see that quite clearly, energy. Did you have a question or comment, Ken?
I have a comment. Usually when I see doubt, I usually see it paired with indecision. And as far as pairing up, I felt uncomfortable that it was isolated because usually indecision comes up with doubt, you know.
Yes, thank you for that clarification. Yeah, so if I were to... So if you imagine in that center circle it said doubt and indecision. So thank you, Ken. So now, in relationship to one-pointedness, asking this question of what gets left behind. And now I'd like to share with you just a little story. And the point of this story is to say that, is to communicate that this first dhyana is not some esoteric state. It's not some highly refined state that's, you know, you got to go to a mountaintop and meditate for a month to enter into this state. It's actually something that's readily accessible. And I imagine that most of us have touched into this state and perhaps may have not named it as such. So I'd like to just share a simple story with you, and then also invite you to explore your own experience around this. And this story is it involves a very close friend of mine. His name's Jeff. And we went to college together, so we've been friends for like 30 years or something like that. And a few years ago, his wife gave him a birthday present, and it was a gift certificate to a pottery class. And my friend Jeff had never taken a pottery class before, but he actually has a very strong artistic bent to him. So he went to this pottery class, quite interested to see what would unfold. And it turned out he loved it, absolutely loved it. And I happened to be visiting him at the time he was taking this class. I was really curious about it. Oh, so what do you love about this class? And it's just when I go there, I don't know, it's all my worries, whatever's going on, it just evaporates. And I just simply become mesmerized by the act of pottery, throwing a pot. I was really struck by this word mesmerized, right? To become mesmerized. So I was, can you take me there? I want to see it. I said, yeah, sure. So we went there. He took me on a little tour of the studio. And when we were there, there was another artist there who was throwing a pot. And she was actually very skilled. And I knew this because in the room there are these large racks where the artists have their work, you know, with their names. So all people's work were there. So look around. And I noticed that this particular artist, because Jeff pointed her out to me, she says, oh yeah, she's really amazing here, look at her work. So I began watching her throwing this pot. I don't know anything about pottery, I've never seen anyone throw a pot. It's basically, you got some clay and you got a wheel and got some water. And as I was watching her, I became mesmerized by just watching her. There was something about it that was so beautiful in its simplicity. So what are the qualities here that I'm pointing at in terms of being mesmerized? And this is what one-pointedness, this turn of phrase, is pointing at. So it is this quality of wholehearted engagement, undivided attention, wholehearted engagement with our present moment experience. Nothing is left out in this unification of mind, in this process of becoming mesmerized. And what is not present is desire for sense pleasure, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, anxiety, and doubt. What's not present is this mind that just loves, that tends to ruminate, that tends to think all sorts of thoughts. Nothing is left out, so our mind is completely engaged with our present moment experience. So this can arise in nature. It can arise listening to music, beautiful music, or it can arise engaging in some physical activity, perhaps like dance or sport or something like this. So it's what's commonly referred to in psychological terms as flow, state of flow. So this is a fairly common experience. If we just simply tune in and notice, we may have some experiences that map to this. So that's one pointedness. Initial thought, sustained thought. Well, that's interesting. Why is there thinking involved when one is meditating? And then it dissolves. What's that about? So if we go back to this idea of throwing a pot, so rather than me watching someone throw a pot, if I were to imagine myself throwing a pot, I can imagine that there would still be thinking going on, and the thinking is directly related to the present moment experience. The thinking mind that's happening here is in support of the present moment experience. So it's not in the foreground. The thinking is not pulling us away. It's not thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner or blah, 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 complaining about someone else. The thinking is all about the present moment experience. It's in relationship to it. So in a particular way, the thinking becomes part of our present moment experience. So in terms of this transition into from the first dhyana to the second dhyana, the way that I experience this when I'm meditating is, let's say I'm starting from a quite distracted mind. When I sit down, I'll just notice that my mind will be all over the map. And I know that if I just sit and just allow the mind to settle down, that it will. Sometimes it takes a little more time than others, but it does settle down. And then I'll notice with the thinking mind, I will notice that the pace of my thoughts will begin to gradually slow down. The pace of my thoughts. And also I notice that the volume of my thoughts begin to slow down as well. Like there's this unwinding that happens. What comes to mind is, like, if you've been working really hard, then you go on vacation, and your vacation involves a lot of laying around. Maybe it's at the beach. And you have this experience of, oh, you know, it kind of takes me a couple days just to settle into vacation mode. It takes a couple days for this habitual thinking mind to unwind itself. So this is what happens in meditation. We can unwind the mind. So rather than our minds being all scattered, we actually can unify the mind, unify the heart, unify the body. So as the thinking mind begins to quiet down, as we can become more and more engaged with our experience of our breathing bodies, thinking will actually just become so quiet that it does dissolve. It's very interesting, this process of the thinking mind stopping and dissolving. So, I've heard people say this. I don't know about that. You know, whenever I sit and meditate, my mind just goes, well, just all over the map. And the thought of the thinking mind stopping is, Or perhaps one can relate to this as, oh, the reason I'm meditating is to stop thinking. So one can also have that approach to meditation. So in terms of the thinking mind, here's a really interesting little exploration, is if you tune into the space between your thoughts, you will notice that there's no thinking in those gaps between your thoughts. They're quite small. But if you really tune in, you will notice that there are gaps there in your thinking. So this idea that we're always thinking, it's a really interesting thing to explore and to question. There are gaps in our thinking. And if we attune to those gaps, and if we create the intention to have those gaps extend, to broaden out, if we have the intention to really step into those gaps, to invite them to arise, they will arise. They will naturally arise. So now moving on to rapture and bliss. So in the English language, we can just simply look at them. Well, those sound like synonyms to me. Why are they listed differently? And what's being pointed at here when one dissolves and then both dissolves? What's that about? So the first thing I'd like to say is that rapture and bliss, to speak of this in general, it's joy. That the unified mind, when one enters into a state of unification of the mind and heart, that this state is naturally imbued with joy. It's joy and well-being and warmth. That this is a natural quality. So in relationship to joy, if we bring back to mind the five hindrances, so when the five hindrances are present, the mind and heart tends to be quite agitated or subtly agitated. We'll be somewhere on this spectrum of restlessness or sloth and torpor. There can be a lot of stuff going on here. And when those subside, what naturally arises is joy. And this joy is directly related to being released from the five hindrances. So joy and suffering are really two sides of the same coin. When suffering is not present, joy is present. So I like approaching rapture and bliss, making this distinction with a little analogy. And this is it's kind of Buddhist. There's a part of it that's Buddhist. So the analogy is like, imagine you're walking in the desert. Not that many of us have done that, but that's from the Pali Canon. Imagine you're walking through the desert and running out of water, getting a little worried. And then imagine off in the distance you see another group of travelers coming towards you. And as you approach them, you see that they're satiated. They're carrying large bags of water. Their clothing is wet. And they tell you, oh, there's an oasis just that way. You're quite close. And you would experience a sense of joy. Oh, this is fantastic. Oh, perfect. So you continue to walk. And more travelers, you pass them on the road, and they too have wet clothes and whatnot. And then you arrive at this oasis, and you see this beautiful setting. Right? Ah, yes. Right? Then what do you do next? You get in the water. Oh, you drink, you bathe. Oh, it feels so good. And then you get out, and you wrap yourself in a white cloth, and you just sit upon the shore of this pool of water. So in this analogy, we can see that there's an arc, an emotional arc in this journey of joy. So the initial discovery that there's an oasis nearby, this can fill us with joy. It can be very exciting. Yes! And then getting in the water, actually experiencing that which we are desiring. That is also very joyous. And it has quite a different quality to it. This joy of, it's more stable, if you will, this bliss that's being pointed at here. That would be analogous to actually being in the water, being in this oasis. And then when one gets out of the water and wraps oneself in a wet white cloth, now your desire for water has been fulfilled, has been satiated. And then we can sit on the side of the bank, just, And again, there's a shift in the quality of this joy. And this is actually what's being pointed at in terms of the arising of rapture. It's the, perhaps we could say, the initial entering into a state of absorption, the initial realization, the seeing clearly of the absence of the five hindrances. This joy, this rapture can arise. And then we can rest in this joy, this experience of the unification of mind, this nourishment, this warmth. And then what can happen is that sense of joy can then actually will begin to subside. And what unfolds is what's referred to as the fourth dhyana, where both rapture and bliss are no longer present, and what arises is what's referred to as equanimity. So, equanimity, first I'll read what the Buddha says about equanimity. Actually, the adjectives he uses to describe equanimity. On the attainment of the fourth level of dhyana, there remains only equanimity. Pure and bright, pliant, malleable, and luminous. On the attainment of the fourth level of dhyana, there remains only equanimity. Pure and bright, pliant, malleable, and luminous. I love these adjectives. Pure and bright, malleable, luminous. Mm. So equanimity, what's being pointed at here, is an even-mindedness, a deep acceptance of our present moment experience, and an even-minded relationship towards the contents of that experience. So if we compare that experience of equanimity with what arises when the five hindrances are present, we are, when the five hindrances are present, we're very interested in the contents of our experience, and our relationship to the contents may or may not be so even-mindedness. So by even-mindedness, this means joy arises, that's just fine. Ill will arises, that's just fine. Yeah? Sense desire, that's just fine. Sloth and torpor arises, that's just fine. There's this deep acceptance of our experience just as it is, without any desire or inkling to want it to be something other than what it is. So equanimity. Yes. Okay. I just wrote down here, I wanted to just say where I got this this table from. This is from a book by Kamala Shila, and it's called Buddhist Meditation. It's actually in the bookstore out front. So now I'd like to shift gears a little bit. This is what's traditionally taught about the dhyanas, about concentration. And I'll share with you another story about my journey of developing skill in meditation. Is when I really dived into this, it was actually through a book by Shaila Catherine called Focused and Fearless. And in this book, Shaila Catherine, she writes very eloquently about her experience of these eight dhyanas, the first four and the second four, which I will not be discussing tonight. And she goes into these quite detailed descriptions of her personal experience of abiding in these various states of concentration. And I read this book, and I got really interested in it. And what arose for me was the measuring mind, the striving mind, the judging mind. And I was, my lute string became too taut after reading this book. Because I thought to myself, oh, yeah, I want that. I want bliss. I want rapture. I want equanimity. I want, if she can do it, I can do it too. Well, you know. So I approached my meditation practice with too much energy. My lute string was too taut. And this blocked the arising of these deeper states of concentration. So I was relating to these things very much with a grasping mind. So this is something that's very important to keep an eye out for, to be watchful of, to be mindful of. So it may not be helpful to actually try and parse your experience in these well-defined buckets, if you will. Because as we all know, our experience does not fall into well-defined buckets. We don't just simply march through the dhyanas and then into liberation. It's not the way practice unfolds. Practice unfolds uniquely for each one of us. Yeah. So rather than speaking about the dhyanas in this sort of linear way, if you will, we can speak about our relationship to meditation in a much more holistic way. So let's consider a different theme, a different approach to relating to meditation practice. So we can consider this theme, that focusing upon samadhi, meditation practice and concentration, that this is an activity of of filling the body with warmth, the body, heart, and mind with warmth, love, and well-being. And that this filling the body with nourishment, that there is a spectrum. So this picture that's being painted here is simply a spectrum of warmth, love, nourishment, and inspiration. We could also consider another theme, closely related theme, which is cultivating samadhi is a process of developing skill, the skill of letting go. The skill of letting go of the measuring mind, the harsh inner critic, the judging mind, the mind that says, I'm not good enough, I'm no good at this, something wrong with me, I can't do this, all of that stuff. Yes, letting go. Vipassana, insight. So now I'd just like to preview some of the things we'll be exploring in Sangha Night in the month of August. Vipassana practice, which is insight practice. So here I'll first say something about how does samadhi practice, samatha practice, practices which calm the mind, and insight practices, or vipassana practices, which lead to clear seeing. What's the relationship between these two types of practice? And what is vipassana practice? What is insight practice? So, again, samatha, unification of the mind. And it turns out that when one mind becomes unified, it's actually a very supportive condition to explore the nature of our experience, to explore insight in vipassana. So samatha practice very much supports this. If our minds are distracted, we're all over the place, it's quite hard to focus. So samatha helps us focus, and then vipassana is focus on what? The nature of our experience. Yeah. So I think that's all I'll say about this. What I'd like to do now is we're not going to break up into small groups. We don't have time for that this evening. But instead, what I'd like to do is I'd like to guide us in a short meditation, about 7 minutes or so, 5 to 7 minutes. So to recap, one of the things I said about wisdom is I'd spoken about what's traditionally referred to as three levels of wisdom. There's the first level of wisdom comes from listening, hearing, or reading. The second level of wisdom comes from reflection, turning over something in one's mind, exploring the implications of a particular teaching. And the third level of wisdom arises through meditation. Listening and hearing, reflection, and meditation. So what I'm going to do is I would like to guide us in this little meditation. And what I'll be doing is I'll be just simply dropping some questions into our minds. I'll be dropping some pebbles into the pools of our minds. And we'll just have an opportunity to create some space for an answer to arise. And we'll just notice how we relate to questions. So please make yourself comfortable in your meditation postures. What is my relationship to my mind? Do I relate to my mind as unruly? untamed. Has my mind ever felt pure and bright, pliant, malleable and luminous? What is my relationship to the activity of shaping my mind in a more positive direction? Am I willing? Am I able?